Willkommen zu Gastrogeplauder, dem gastroenterologischen Wissenspodcast der DGVS.
Willkommen zur nächsten Folge von Gastrogeplauder. Wir haben ein spezielles Thema and we have a very special guest. Welcome, Barbara Bastiansen from Amsterdam.
Thank you, Professor Rush. It's a pleasure.
Barbara, there is a brand new paper out in GUT from your group, and it's a hot topic nowadays. A new acronym, EID, endoscopic intermuscular dissection.
That's right.
Which is, if I may summary, an ESD including the first muscle layer, right?
Exactly. So it's just an adaptation of the ESD technique. It's just a different plane. So, yeah.
And it happens mostly or almost exclusively in the rectum?
Yeah, I think it's only possible in the rectum, although I did see a case report of an endoscopic intermuscular dissection now in the stomach, which I don't have experience in. But in the rectum, it's of course completely safe and the muscle layer is so well developed, you can actually indeed divide these two muscle layers. Higher up in the sigmoid, I don't think it's possible anymore. You already feel that. When you move higher up in the rectum, the intermuscular plane becomes very, narrow, small. And then the risk of injuring the full muscle is higher. And of course, in the sigmoid, that is a problem. In the rectum, it's not so much of a problem.
As well known from surgery.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, what I like with this technique, of course, it's some kind of technical progress, but basically it uses the same technology as for ESD.
That's right.
But it sort of marks a big clinical progress because the whole thinking changes with localized rectal cancer.
Yeah.
Away from big surgery to organ preservation.
That's right.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit how you got the idea that we could go beyond current guidelines, which have been very, very narrow
and
patients
strict.
Have to be sent to surgery, etc. Yeah. So what's the history of EID?
Yeah, the history is that we already were busy with full thickness resection in the colon by the EFTR technique. And that's because our guideline in Holland is a little bit different. So we disregarded depth of invasion as a indicator for surgery already a long time ago. So the guideline in the Netherlands wanted a 1 millimeter cancer-free resection margin, which of course in the normal endoscopic techniques, which are submucosal techniques, is never possible to have a 1 millimeter or at least it's difficult with, for example, a snare. So moving from endoscopic full thickness resection, I was in an ESD course already quite some years ago in 2018. And then because it's not completely new, the endoscopic intermuscular dissection, it was that the type of technique was already published in endoscopy before and was called peranal endoscopic myectomy. But it was performed not for deeper cancers, but for very severe fibrotic lesions. And I saw the technique being shown in a video. And then, of course, I was already working on deeper invasive lesions in the colon. And then I really, the technique was striking to me. And I thought this is perfect for deeper invasive cancer, for better histology to have this muscle layer underneath the cancer.
So basically, you were inspired by endoscopic techniques and not sitting in such a tight guideline prison.
Yeah, that's right.
Like in other countries. So, you and others developed the data that the depth of infiltration per se is probably not, or very likely not, an independent risk factor as long as you fully resect it.
Yeah.
This 1 millimeter is not valid for endoscopists anymore because otherwise we would have to send almost everybody, esophagus, stomach, to surgery, right?
That's right, yeah. So in I don't know how it's not so clear what is a free margin in the European guidelines. In Holland, we say it needs to be 0.1 millimeter free. Mm-hmm. So at least an accessible margin free of cancer is enough if it's a good quality specimen, yeah.
Yeah, that's another issue. We once did a study where we were very in much detail studying the resection plane.
Yeah.
And in up to 30%, we found kind of holes in the submucosa.
Yeah.
So there was no submucosa at all, in which case an R0 is maybe not reliable. So, but we don't want to go into the depth of histopathology and margins.
Yeah.
So here you have a technique where you go between the muscle layers and then what's left is theoretically the longitudinal outer muscle layer.
Yes.
What happens if it's even deeper? If you go there and see, oh, it's infiltrating deeper. Do you go deeper and leave a hole?
Yes, if necessary. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have to check on the MRI whether it's safe to go full thickness in this certain mm-hmm. lesion. And of course, you need to be a little bit reluctant for a full thickness resection in certain areas, especially in the ventral side of the rectum when there's very mm-hmm. little mesorectal fat. You need to be careful not to cause fistulas. We learned that from our transanals, from our surgeons. But in general, if there is a good mesorectal plane behind it, you don't need to worry mm-hmm. if to go full thickness. And it's also something I learned from our surgeons. They rinse the transmural defect and leave it open mostly. And that's something we took over.
And both surgeons and patients go home.
Exactly.
Okay. This brings us to a very, very important point, which is case selection.
Yeah.
So you have an endoscopic aspect. It's probably mostly frank cancer, a cancer
that really looks
which
like
everybody
cancer.
Sees it looks it's like not cancer. Good. What imaging tests do you require?
Yeah. So for us, it's a minimum is an MRI of the rectum, of the pelvis. And that's most important to, of course, exclude nodes, but you hardly ever see them in early cancers. Mm-hmm. I mean, how often do you find a suspicious node? And we know also that the sensitivity of those positive nodes is all not that good. So, but if we see clear invasion through the muscle, if there's a T3B lesion, for example, on MRI, and the lesion looks really ugly, then we are reluctant to go on for mm-hmm. EID. So the criteria we still keep is at least a C, so clinical staging on MRI T1/T2.
Okay.
Yeah.
US?
Yeah, to be honest, I do not believe so strongly if EOS can make the difference between a deep T1 and an early T2. Neither modality, right? I mean, it's the same with how can we ever see the difference between a high-grade dysplasia or invasion just through the muscularis mucosa into the difference between a deep T1 or early T2 is very complicated with any modality. So it's histology. Yeah.
So that's MRI, not US for gross morphology, which stops you.
Yeah.
In the gray zone, you might consider, depending on patient age, et cetera, et cetera.
And if there's mesorectum
CT,
behind.
CT, liver mets, or at least ultrasound?
Yeah. No, actually, we start with the MRI. If the MRI doesn't show nodes, we do the resection. And depending on histology, we will continue with CT afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we don't need full CT staging, mm-hmm. or we don't do before resection.
Because your experience shows it's extremely rare that you have distant metastasis.
Okay. At that early stage, and you don't make staging more complicated by doing the resection first. And if it's a low-risk case, you don't need the full staging.
Okay, now let's go to the paper. So that's a total of 188 cases.
Yeah.
Where you and your colleague Leon Moons,
it's a
two-center study.
Yeah.
And other colleagues thought there would be suitable cases. So you have MRI and all your criteria. And what I really find remarkable that obviously the assessment is so-so. Mm-hmm. Because the target group is cancer with submucosal invasion. Mm-hmm. But the cancer definition, as we know, starts with submucosal invasion, mm-hmm. but not SM1. So the ideal group is SM2,
3.
Yeah. And in fact, you had about, I think, 16% with lower stage, even high grade.
11% were non-invasive lesions.
High grade?
Yeah, mostly high grade. And 5% were early invasive, so SM1. And then we had 54% of deep invasive T1, so SM2, SM3, mm-hmm. that were in total 94 cases. But also we had 31% T2 lesions. Yeah.
A third case is
T2.
Actually too deep. Let's talk about this at the end, but potentially too deep for at least your initial target.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. And that I think shows that even people, you know, focused on this disease cannot make an accurate diagnosis of infiltration depth. And I'm deeply skeptical towards, you know, endoscopic assessment. We have experience in the esophagus, at least in the West. Maybe Japanese are magicians and they can do that. But okay, so that's a very important message. And then if you take your target group, those 94 cases, the results were actually pretty good.
It is, yeah. So we know, and we knew that already from the meta-analysis showing that depth of invasion is not an independent risk factor. We knew already from the meta-analysis around 40% of deep invasive lesions do not have any other risk factor. And what was nice to see that it was confirmed in this study, because of all deep invasive rectal lesions, T1. Indeed, also here, 37% did not have any other additional risk mm-hmm. factors. So according to the Dutch guideline also, all those none of these patients had adjuvant therapy.
No surgery, no radiotherapy,
mm-hmm. none of them. And at 3 years follow-up in this group, there were no distant metastases, no. And what we did see in the group of the deep invasive lesions without any other risk factors, we had 7% recurrences. That was one lymph node metastasis and one intramural mm-hmm. recurrence. But that 7% maybe sounds a little bit high for a recurrence in a low-risk lesion. Mm-hmm. In the colon, it would be high, but we know that it's exactly the same as a superficially invasive rectal lesion. So a low-risk superficial T1 in the rectum, we know from data that indeed mm-hmm. the risk of recurrence is 7%.
Well, honestly,
the rectum is different.
If it was zero, I wouldn't believe it. And I think we endoscopists always have the tendency to apologize if we don't reach 100%.
That's
impossible.
Yeah, right? That's right. Though yeah. I just want to show that the depth of mm-hmm. invasion doesn't matter. Also yeah. not here. The 7% is what we expect in the rectum mm-hmm. in a low-risk case, which is not a problem if you can salvage.
Huh? Yes.
So those two cases were treated by salvage, one with surgery and one with adjuvant chemoradiation.
Because that's also a very important aspect in the informed consent for patients. If you mm-hmm. say, okay, we do the less invasive treatment first, and if something happens, it's not too late.
Yeah.
And too late would be distant metastasis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if it's local regional, including lymph nodes, it's not too late.
That's
right. You still can do something with obviously, I mean, low numbers, but a pretty good prognosis.
Yeah, yeah. Patients do not die from the local regional recurrence. Yeah, so if you follow that way of doing your local excision first and base your next steps on histology, yeah, that saves a lot of rectums, right? I mean...
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're sort of getting back to the surgical principle, in doubt, take it out.
Yeah.
And then we'll see, because the assessment is not reliable. Then we have a very precise histopathology by expert histopathologists. I think, very important. And then you can base your decision on the risk you know.
Yeah.
You also have to say the more risk factors, the higher was the rate of surgery. Of course.
Yeah.
But there were still patients with even more than one risk factor who opted for surveillance.
Yeah.
And then subgroups become very small. And so you can't tell much. But even obviously a T2 cancer, fully resected, no additional lymph nodes, small subgroup, but they also tend to do pretty well.
Yeah. I think my feeling is if we will have bigger groups of T2 without risk factors, I think they are quite the same for a T1 mm-hmm. SM3 without mm-hmm. risk factors. The same. It's just that when you move deeper into the plains, of course, the chance of hitting a risk factor is higher. So the chance of having a low risk T2, I think, will be something around 10-20%. Mm-hmm. We know we have 40% in the deep T1s, but low risk T2 will be
even lower.
The group will be lower.
Because the risk factors grow alongside the infiltration depth.
That's right.
More or less. So when a patient comes to you, this is what you tell them. And I guess most of the patients accept it happily, right? And go for this first as a step up.
Yes.
What future studies do we need?
Yeah.
I think just multiply the numbers to be sure that the confidence intervals get smaller, mm-hmm. the subgroups get bigger, or do you have to randomize?
I think there's a few important questions we need to answer. First of all, there is this feeling, if we look at our recurrences rate that we see now, of course the subgroups are still small, but what we see is that it seems to be lower than we know from Tamtami's surgery series. The risk, because there's, for example, there's one paper from the Netherlands showing a recurrence, local recurrence of almost 20% in mostly low risk cases. And it's difficult to understand what's happening there oncologically. And I don't know if it's the technique of Tamis with the pneumorectum or the grasp.
Lesion visibility?
Maybe. Or
margins? If it's an adenoma at the margins, flat? We don't know.
No, but in cancers, also cancer.
Cancer in the middle, but maybe they have...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
or is it seeding? Or is it seeding?
Yeah. Seeding is another very interesting factor we don't know enough by far, even in the endoscopic area.
That's right. But it is an interesting concept to think about, why is that recurrence so high in the rectum compared to the colon, for example? Mm-hmm. And is it indeed seeding? And is that maybe a benefit of the intermuscular plane? Or at least I think we as endoscopists, I don't want to insult anybody, but we're so close on what is dissecting. We're really underneath the lesion, and we see that we leave this little film over the mesorectum, mesorectal fat intact. It's like a fiber spider web just below the longitudinal muscle that you actually can preserve. So you don't open the mesorectal fat, and maybe it's just a cleaner way of cutting.
That's what we're hoping, right?
That's what we're hoping.
So, Barbara, of course, next question, how dangerous is this? Complications.
Yeah, actually, we consider it as a safe procedure. There are, of course, complications. We had a total number of complications of 18.5%, but those were mainly based on post-procedural pain. 17% of those were just needing. So in the Greek classification, the need for analgesics is a complication. Mm-hmm. So that mainly it was pain. There were a few more severe complications, graded as 3A. That was one or two cases with a stenosis needing dilatation.
With more extensive resection, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, that was 80% of the circumference, actually. Yeah, and there was one delayed bleeding needing a re-endoscopy without any blood transfusions or anything.
But what we must fear is, abscess and, local complications peritonitis, but the spread of infection.
Yeah, or peritoneal entry. Yeah. We were afraid for that when we started, but actually we had no perirectal abscesses and there was not one case of entry of the peritoneum. So we were lucky with that. There was just one unlucky case of a patient on high-dose prednisone where we had a very severe E. coli sepsis within 24 hours of the resection without signs of a peritonitis. There was no perforation, but a very severe sepsis. The patient died of this sepsis. But that is something I think that has nothing to do on the depth of in dissection, because you have these unlucky sepsis cases also in ESD. But of course,
again, there's no such thing as a zero complication rate.
No.
And it happens in surgery, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, one very important question is quality of life and functional results. Mm-hmm. Did you look into that?
Actually, we had structured telephone interviews with the first 140 cases we did, and also were sent out LARS questionnaires, so on functional results. Mm-hmm. And we see that, first of all, that 95% of all procedures and patients are back to their normal activities within 1 week, of which 80% is recovering fully within 3 days even. So we schedule these procedures already as an outpatient procedure. So patients kept in the hospital for observation for 1 or 2 hours and then they go home.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But that's also our ESD practice. And I think it's not in every clinic the same, but
So if you compare it to surgical local resection, we had the point before that obviously the recurrence rate could potentially, perhaps, hopefully be lower with ESD EID, so with endoscopic resections. Do you also think that functional results are maybe better?
Yeah, well, if we look at the LARS questionnaires that were taken, of course, the numbers are still small, but it seems very, very good. So we see LARS results, severe LARS in 5% of the cases. But then when you send out these questionnaires just in a normal patients without a rectal resection or a local rectal resection, you will find severe LARS in patients also in 5%. So that's what you really expect. And that's good if you compare it to Tammy's papers out there showing their functional results, the LARS that they report is higher. So somewhere
LARS
around
is impairment, the
20%.
Questionnaire and the impairment of function, defecation function and other things. Yeah,
fragmentation and
Yeah, okay, Barbara, thanks very much. Exciting new paper. Please read it.
Yes.
And I think there should be more studies, prospective studies, well documented. The question is whether it's ever possible to randomize it to the big surgery, TME. But anyway, I think it's a good perspective, but we have to be oncologically careful and really follow up those patients as you do.
That's critical. Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Barbara, and we hope we have you back soon with more results on this. Thank you.
Thanks you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Und Ihnen vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Schreiben Sie uns Anregungen, Wünsche, Kritik und bis nächste Woche. Vielen Dank.
Das war Gastrogeplauder, der gastroenterologische Wissenspodcast der DGVS. Alle Informationen und Links zur Folge finden Sie in den Shownotes und unter dgvs.de/podcast. Haben Sie Feedback oder Fragen zur Folge oder möchten Sie ein Thema vorschlagen, dann schreiben Sie uns an podcast@dgvs.de. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal bei Gastrogeplauder.